This is the Thanks for Sharing podcast, the podcast where we explore all things recovery, healing, and relationship.
Remember to subscribe and download episodes in the iTunes Store, the Google Play Store, or on the Podbean app.
You can find more Thanks for Sharing at www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com or on Facebook at facebook.com/healingpaths. That's paths with an S. Hello and welcome to the Thanks for Sharing podcast. I'm John T.
And I'm Jackie P.
Today we're going to be going back to our What's Missing series and adding another episode. We're going to talk about the ability to argue, because that's something that we don't see real present or real productive with a lot of the folks in recovery that we work with.
Right. We see their ability to argue in dysfunctional ways, in ways that take them away from their goal, but not really in ways that actually bring resolution or are productive.
Yeah, so that's actually where I wanted to start, was being able to differentiate maybe between some synonyms for argument, because mm-hmm. I think that can be confusing. I see argument as a process of defining my needs, wants, desires, who I am, defining your needs, wants, desires, mm-hmm. who you are, and being able to stay separate and differentiated through that exploration.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of the clients that I work with, they see argument as a win-lose, and they want to win.
So it's more like a fight.
Yeah, they want to be right.
Yeah.
It's a fight to win. It's a fight to be right, because that means that they're better than. That means that they're okay. That means that, you know, their narrative gets to dominate.
Yeah. Or I think we can have those folks who know that they're never going to win, or they uh-huh. kind of have that, like, I'm just never good enough thing going on. So yeah. The goal of the argument becomes to inflict maximum damage.
Yes. Which, again, we're also talking about ways to engage in an argument, right? And one of the ways that sometimes gets overlooked is to withdraw and go silent.
Yeah.
That is still a way to engage in the argument. You're doing it in an extremely passive way.
Right.
But it is still an F you.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would say that FU is at the core of how addicts, how people with intimacy disorders argue.
Yep.
It's become like, how can I stomp on your foot? How can I
yes.
hurt you? Rather than recognizing that that process of argument or that process of differentiation can actually move us to uh-huh. some healthier outcomes.
Well, I think there's a difference when we're arguing from a place of, you know, that in the brain and in the nervous system, it's registering danger.
Uh-huh.
We're gonna fight different.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna argue differently when our brain is feeling threat or danger than when we're in a place of differentiation and trying to navigate and work through and understand.
Yeah, it's like in that place of threat, the important information may not be registering, or all of the pertinent information may not be registering.
Yeah.
It's more about this attack-defend dynamic with the other person rather than it is about the information that's being shared back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That reminds me, I think I've shared this story before on the podcast. One of the first times, I guess you could say it's one of the first times my wife and I argued about the nature of the dysfunction in my family.
Okay.
We had been at a family dinner, and during the course of this dinner, one of my siblings had ended up screaming, literally screaming at another one of my adult siblings. It took me right back to childhood. It was so, such a great trip home.
Memory lane.
Right. And we get in the car and we're driving back to our apartment. We lived like 30 minutes away. We're driving back and my wife says to me, "Well, that was weird." And I said, "What? What was weird?" And she's like, "I don't know, the fact that one of your siblings screamed at your other sibling and that sibling kept poking after the screaming started." And I said, "That's not weird, that's normal." Like,
and your wife is thinking, "Okay, now this is weird."
No, she did. Like, okay. she puts her hands in her hair and she's like, "You are making me feel crazy. Like, that is not normal." And it took me, like, it probably took me 40 minutes of this back and forth to realize, like, we were having a conversation about an emotional experience.
Right.
Not this conversation about how messed up my family was. Like, she was trying to tell me what she was feeling. I was seeing this as a threat to, like, how I had organized my whole universe. And so I was fighting her on it. I was right. crazy making her on it. But I wasn't recognizing the information that needed to be exchanged. And that was actually, like, after that 40 minutes when I could start to see that, that was one of those watershed moments for my own recovery, saying, like, I've gotten accustomed to some pretty dysfunctional things. Mm. Like, there are some things that are not registering for me that I think need to be registering mm-hmm. for me.
I was talking to one of my brothers on the phone the other day, and this particular brother is involved in some politics here in the state of Utah. And so things have been, needless to say, you know, March was an awful month for him. It kind of, I said to him, March came in like a lion and it went out like a lion. Right. Like, wow, are you still living? But he had a position because of his office. He had a decision to make that he knew, like, somebody's going to be mad about this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think my brother does a good job at what he does, and he wanted to be well-informed. He wanted to really consider a lot of the impact of this decision and really think things through. And so he went to a lot of different town meetings. And one in particular was the worst, like,
yeah.
stop short of physical violence.
I think it made national news.
I think so too. And, you know, and he was just like, he's like, before the meeting even started, he's like, we never had control of the meeting.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he just said it literally, this one particular, which was the worst, he's like, it was 4 hours of people screaming into microphones mm-hmm. at us. And he's like, they didn't even want an answer. Mm-hmm. You know, he's like, because if we ever started to talk, they just kept screaming.
Yeah.
He's like, so there was no interest in dialogue, in understanding, in, he's like, really even in expressing where they were coming from, because you can't really understand where someone's coming from when they're screaming into a microphone at you. You know, and I said, yeah, I've watched this in the news, and I've heard different interviews he's done throughout the month. And I said, I wondered how triggering this is for you, because this happened in our home,
mm-hmm.
not with microphones. thank goodness.
It was not that organized.
But it was loud anyway. But I said, or if you feel like your childhood prepared you for this. And he was like, yeah, I don't think it really triggered anything for me. I also think he doesn't fully remember stuff, but he's like, I don't think it triggered anything for me. He's like, I was kind of like, I've been conditioned for this. I've been prepping since I was young for this moment. He's like, I still didn't like it, but yeah, he's like, I could just kind of build a wall between me and them, which also, you know, if there are walls going up, this argument really isn't going to be effective.
Yeah, I think, like, I think back to group interactions, our recovery groups that we have, or even our groups for spouses, and I look at those interactions, and most of the group issues that ended up blowing up or turning into this, we talk about this storm phase of a group mm-hmm. where the group members are trying to get to know each other and what's okay and what's not. I think one of those elements that is in quote-unquote arguments for people before they figure out arguments is there's this hierarchical approach to it.
Right.
Like, there's an alpha and there's a beta, and as long as I know where I'm at,
mm-hmm.
I'm fine.
Right. And both can have power roles.
Right.
They look differently, but both have their own way of grabbing power.
Yeah. And that's something I've noticed about that argument dynamic, especially as you bring up these town hall meetings. Like, it can have the feel that there's this, sometimes it's a very blatant struggle for who gets to be the alpha.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes, you know, you can see one side like, I don't want to be an alpha. I just want to hear you, or I want
right.
you to hear me.
Right.
And the other side is interpreting that as a threat to their alpha position, imagining that
yep.
like, that's part of this 4 hour scream fest.
Yeah.
Like, there's no need for a power struggle there. But I think a lot of times people go into arguments or disagreements or differences with this. Somebody's going to be right. Somebody's going to be wrong. Somebody's going to uh-huh. be in charge. Somebody's going to take a beating.
Right.
And we can get really defensive around that. Or we can even get, I think we can even get hell-bent on, I'm going to be the one that takes a beating.
Yes.
Like, nobody else gets to be hurt in this
yeah.
but me.
Well, and I think in those situations, right, if we're going into an argument, grabbing power, there's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going into arguments in this binary viewpoint, right, wrong, good, bad, alpha, beta, you know, all of that, it sets us up. The structure right there is not a winnable for anyone.
Yeah.
Right. Even if there is a winner, somebody comes out feeling like they won. You don't win in situations like that.
Right.
You know, there's no medals handed out. And in terms of productivity, I mean, you may have been able to show your power and flex your arm the most, but that's not generally the goal in helpful arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And generally in helpful arguments, again, we may be going from two different sides of a perspective, and both are going to move.
Right. Well, that's some of the research. I think it's come out in social media. Like, we can see this in traditional media outlets. Like, the more extreme and the louder the position stated, the more likely you are to entrench in the position that you already have.
Yes. We call it confirmation bias.
Mm-hmm.
And all that's really happening is we're strengthening confirmation bias.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which I've started listening to Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow.
Oh, yeah. I started that once, too.
You started that once?
I started
it's long. It's like 20 hours.
And it's like dense info.
Right. He won a Nobel Prize.
I know. I forgot I started it.
Yeah. I think there's a reason why it's been on my list for like 4 years. But in the last weekend, like four people have brought it up. I'm like, okay, universe, I'll listen to it.
Yeah.
But that's one of the things he talks about, is that we have some different systems in our brain. One system that gathers information very quickly and very generally, and one that's more like this slow grinding mill that really takes in and evaluates, and I can look at that, and oftentimes we're using that very surface generalization information gathering system, which really lends itself to not just a confirmation bias, but all sorts of biases.
Right.
Like, I'm only going to see in this what I really want to see in this.
Mm-hmm. Well, and anytime we do kind of a drive-by look at something, clearly we're going to miss some stuff.
Right.
But for some people, and I've worked with clients like this, you've worked with clients like this, they don't really care about that.
Right.
Because they just want to be right.
Well, and you go back to the state of the nervous system, and it's not, I don't think their nervous system is in a place where it's even fathoming or acknowledging that safety can exist.
Mm-hmm.
It's just threat.
Yeah.
So like anything that is not oriented around, is this threatening or is this not, it's not important information. We're meeting with a couple tonight, that we've been working with for quite a while, and we're going to try out, an approach recommended by John and Julie Gottman, called the Aftermath of a Fight.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at, it's a way to help couples reprocess regrettable instances or fights. And I was looking over what you have the couple do in that. And it's actually, it's a lot less about reaching resolution and more about feeling heard.
Okay.
More about letting your partner know that you're actually hearing them and considering, not just formulating the next response. And it really gets you out of that, like, drive-by, let's see what information is on the surface, and you really have to get into that slower-moving process.
Well, and this is one, as you and I have done a lot of joint sessions with couples that we share. One of us works with, you know, both of us work with one member in the partnership. And so we'll do these joint sessions where all four of us are in the room. And that's a way that we work with couples. And we actually find that as we, you know, the session may start in content.
Mm-hmm.
This is what happened. And then this is what he did, or this is what she did. And then she said this, and then I said this, or whatever. But we find that it's okay to start in content, but we've got to go to process.
Yeah.
We've got to go to that, what's happening inside, and really work and do some coaching with a listener one to really know how to listen.
Mm-hmm.
And not listen to respond or mm-hmm. correct or argue, but listen as a way of letting the speaker know that I heard you,
mm-hmm.
You make sense to me, right? Mm-hmm. I may not agree with them, but I can stand in your shoes for a minute and understand why you would feel that way or why this is what you thought, knowing your backstory, knowing your lived mm-hmm. experience, all of that stuff. This makes sense to me. And you know, and then we trade, and the person who was the speaker is now the listener. But we find as we do those, I mean, and this is slow moving work, but we find that the emotions shift.
Yeah.
And what they were arguing about or what they came in fired up about, it doesn't feel the same. It's not the same energy that they walked in the room with.
Mm-hmm.
And they may be more willing to meet each other's needs and to move off of their position once that they have been understood and heard,
mm-hmm.
and once they have really heard and understood their partner, right? Because we're taking it out of this threat zone.
Right. And I think the context and the content of arguments really changes when we recognize what the purpose of the argument is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Gottmans will cite research that says 69% of issues are unresolvable
yep.
in couples.
Because of differences in lived experiences, differences in personality, all of that kind of stuff, it just makes a lot of our arguments unresolvable.
Yeah, they'll say that every marriage is a cross-cultural experience,
yes.
even if you grew up down the street from each other.
Yep.
And I think we get really focused on, like, the purpose of argument or stating my position is to convince somebody else of my position.
Mm-hmm.
Or the purpose of my partner stating their position is to convince me of the position. And mm-hmm. I think when we get into effective argument, it's, I think, less about moving to resolution or moving to action that can be mutually mm-hmm. agreed upon. Although sometimes that comes out of it. But I think the real purpose of argument is to see our partner or to see the other person much more clearly
mm-hmm.
and to see them in their context, not to keep seeing yeah. them in our context.
So, let's move into, unless you have something else to say about that, I think, you know, what you said at the beginning of this episode, talking about really what you just said, that a lot of that argument has to do with, or healthy arguing has to do with this process of differentiation
mm-hmm.
and individuation.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk some more about that.
Yeah. A story has started to come up, or a memory has started to come up for me, back to my working at camp days between when I was 15 and 18. And my uncle was the camp director, and he's a very well-known high school teacher in the area. He teaches...
Daughter number two's favorite high school teacher. Yep.
He teaches history. He did debate for a while. Mm. Like, he has always been somebody of substance to me, and somebody who has scared the crap out of me, just because I didn't have a wheelhouse for someone who worked.
Like, you were afraid of somebody who wears cardigan sweaters,
right? Well, here's what I'd see. It. He had three different kinds of clothes. He was always really involved in scouting, so that was one kind of clothes you'd see him in, a scout uniform.
Oh, okay.
And then he had his work clothes, which was the nice cardigans and bow ties and
yes.
shirts. And then his weekend clothes were the old cardigans, bow ties, and shirts. And I swear, like, this may not be true, but I swear he had a Mr. Rogers thing going on when he came home. Like, he'd come home, his wife babysat us when we were young, my aunt. He would come home, and I swear he would take off one cardigan and put on another.
He'd take off the newer cardigan right. and put on the old cardigan.
Right, put on the weekend relaxing clothes. But anyway, my first summer up there, he would get a lot of students that he taught to come and work at camp, mm. and he would get to know them through the year, and you know, he was known for putting together staffs that worked really well together and did excellent programs. And a lot of that was he didn't bring people to camp that he didn't know very well.
Okay.
So the first year there, a student of his that he really, I think, meshed with intellectually and really liked intellectually, although it took me a while to discover this, because I would see their interactions and it looked like they would argue all the, like, fight mm. all the time, like very intense conversations, like, no, I think you've got this wrong, like, you really need to rethink this. And I remember thinking, like, this kid needs to be careful. He's like a year or two older than me.
Uh-huh.
He's like, this kid needs to be careful or he's going to get fired.
Mm.
And DeLoss, my uncle, would talk all the time about how much he loved this kid mm. and he really appreciated the conversations. And it took me a while to appreciate that while they differed vastly on things,
mm-hmm.
they respected the process.
Mm-hmm. So that would be more maybe of sparring with each other,
yeah.
right? Seeing each other as these equals, even mm-hmm. though they had differences of opinion or beliefs, but they could spar. Yeah. And like you were saying, respect that process of, you know, some of that ideas being shared and pushed against. But underneath that, there was a respect for each other.
Yeah. And I think I got the feeling that clearly they believed that the way that they saw the world was probably the more correct way to see the world. But I think the key was that they were open to other perspectives. They weren't going to be changing their mind anytime soon, but they could listen without being threatened.
Which is some of what that differentiation is, right? That says, this is who I am as a person. But I also know, right, that my beliefs, opinions, ideas, whatever, are also closely connected to my experiences, my upbringing, my things that I've read, things that speak to me, all of that kind of stuff, my personality, my temperament. And so somebody else might see things differently, and that could also be valid. It probably won't change me, right? I may have a conversation with them, and I don't need to walk away completely defeated and be like, ugh, I got to change everything.
Right?
Can I have a conversation with somebody who's different from me and not lose myself?
Yeah. It's kind of that understanding there's a subjective reality.
Yeah.
That's real.
Right.
The key and valid. The key is that it's subjective. Like, I'm seeing my reality through the experience that I've been subjected to, and I'm putting that up against my background. And I make sense of it the way that I make sense of it.
Right.
And you make sense of it the way that you make sense of it. And so I think a big part of that differentiation is we can recognize that there are different narratives which are both true.
Yep.
Which are both accurate.
Yeah.
And one narrative does not threaten another.
Yeah.
However, when we get lost in that that process of fighting, which is like there's got to be a winner or a loser, or, you know, if your reality differs from my reality, there's a problem with one of us, and it sure as hell isn't going to be me.
Yeah.
We get locked in that, like that battle that really doesn't go anywhere.
Well, and that's, I mean, differentiation puts that we have two equally but opposing needs as individuals, right? I have the need to belong to a group or to belong and be accepted by my tribe or peers, whatever that group is. And I also have an equally important and equally weighted need to belong to the self. So in this kind of arguing, there is this need to be authentic, right? To be me and to have that accepted by my group, by my tribe, by my significant other, right? I need to feel like I can be me and I will still be accepted by you. But I still have that need to belong to myself.
Yeah.
So when we start arguing and we feel that I'm expressing my authentic self, and sometimes we aren't, right? Sometimes we're expressing our defensive, walled, protected self, right? But when I'm expressing my authentic self and I start feeling like the other person is saying, you're wrong, right? That's a different kind of threat that I read. And I'm going to fight differently versus them saying, that makes sense. I can accept this. Here's how that makes me feel.
And I think that's a really key part of acceptance. There's words like, I think acceptance and inclusion and hearing and understanding that we mistakenly think are all around positive feelings. Like, if I accept you, I don't see anything wrong with you. And that's the reason why I can accept you.
Right.
Because I don't see anything wrong. You're just like me. I think sometimes acceptance is being able to acknowledge, yes, this is where you're coming from. And I see that. I can also see that that might be painful for me or that might hurt me.
Yep.
And I'm acknowledging that instead of like getting into this, do I only have to have positive feelings for you or is it all negative? Like there can be this ground of I can respect you as a person and I can see you as a whole person. I can also see that that has an impact on me. And part of my acceptance of you is I will talk to you about that impact on me.
I'm not packing my bags and leaving, right? Yeah. I'm not going to threaten you or make you shrink down. But we're going to talk about it.
Whether that's overtly packing my bags and leaving or emotionally, I stonewall, I close off.
Yeah.
I'm not really here.
Yeah. And so that's where we start to see when we have those types of arguments, it actually strengthens the relationship. and each person in the relationship feels more secure and safe in that relationship.
Yeah, we've been doing this Gottman marriage therapy training, and we're both working through the level two videos, watching those, and I just finished this section where they talk about
because we did level one twice.
Right. Well, you know.
That's how John and Jackie do stuff. What? We didn't get that. Let's do it again. Let's not just keep going. Let's do it again.
Yes. Yes. So I've been watching these videos, and they talk about these different aspects that are critical to have working in relationships. And they show a video. They call them the masters and the disasters. Mm-hmm. So the masters are the people who know how to make it work. The disasters are the people who, you know, every time they talk to each other, it's doing damage to the relationship.
Right.
And you notice, like, there were some interactions with the masters. I was like, I don't know how masterful this is. Like,
yes.
This is really hard. And then you would see just this little reach or this little affirmation, like...
Well, and that's, I mean, I don't mean to interrupt, but the Gottmans will talk about, like, it's not like the master's relationships don't have conflict, right? It's not like they, I mean, because they talk about how criticism is not something we should be doing in our relationships, but they'll acknowledge, like, criticism happens for the masters. Contempt even can happen for the masters, right? Sometimes they don't argue really well at all, but they do these reaches. They make these repairs. And when they're not arguing, the way that they see each other and their relationship is secure enough that even in those arguments, they're still more likely to think my partner's having a bad day versus my partner hates me.
Yeah. And I would add there, some of what can make arguing difficult for people in recovery who have not gotten to that relational place yet is they may hear that and say, oh, there's reaches, and they take that as like, I bury feelings or I bury perceptions. Those reaches are very genuine. Despite your flaws, you still matter to me. Despite this difficult time that we're having right now, or this difficult conversation we're having right now, I still value you. And I'm going to reach out. It's not this, I put on a smile, everything's sunshine. It's like we've been talking about, the goal or the outcome of the argument is we feel more bonded. We feel like we understand each other better, rather than I'm trying to convince you of where you're wrong and I'm right.
Right. Well, and we've seen this, the Gottmans talk about this too, but we've seen this with couples we work with where, the security and the safety in the relationship is so disrupted that even if there is a reach, and you and I have been in sessions where we see the reach, but neither of them see it as that at all, right? And so sometimes those reaches are small or seemingly insignificant, and the people in the relationship, it doesn't even register, because what they're looking for is what makes me unsafe in this relationship.
Yeah. Yep. And I would say that's probably the foundation of being able to argue well, is you need to be able to make generous assumptions about the people that you're attempting to build relationships with. It can't be like, you know, 90% of our interactions are okay, and then there's this one interaction that feels off, and all of a sudden you are my worst enemy. Or there's this one interaction where you get really honest with me about how our relationship is feeling, and all of a sudden... Like, it goes from I've idealized you to now I've demonized you.
Right.
We really have to work to make generous and real assumptions about our partner. We can't just cast them all as, we can't cast them all as the villain or the hero.
Right. And trusting yourself and your partner that, you know, we may be having this difficult conversation or a argument may have erupted, but we're going to get through this and be together. We're going to be through this, not just meaning stay together in the relationship, although that's part of it too, but that we're going to have greater understanding. Like, we're going to be closer because we will have some type of understanding that comes out of this.
Yeah. Yeah. So as we start to wrap up this episode, as part of our call out for you valuing your story, we want to hear from you about arguments that meant something to you.
Yeah.
Arguments where you felt like something changed, or you felt like you understood the other person better at the other end. Tell us about some of your successes.
Or even arguments that you had where you realized something about how you were approaching this was not helpful. Right? So that changed things too, because you all of a sudden saw what you were doing and connected it with where it was actually coming from.
Yeah, so you can leave that in the comment section on our website, thanksforsharingpodcast.com. Find this episode. This is episode 29. And as you pull that up, you'll see a place to comment.
At the end of this episode, we remind you that your story matters. Remember, there is something meaningful in every chapter. And don't wait to share your story till it's finished.
You can share your story with us on our Facebook page, Healing Paths, Inc., or on our website, www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com.
This podcast is solely for the purpose of information and entertainment and does not constitute therapy, nor should it replace competent professional help.
At the end of another episode, we want to remind you that nobody has time for perfection. We are pursuing progress.
And remember the prayer of the perfectionist. Help me remember I can't do it all. Help me to take things one step at a time, and that the only step I need to focus on is the next right step for me.
Help me to remember that life is a journey. Help me to be able to separate all that I am learning from all that I have to do. Help me to remember that I am not alone, that I can ask for help. Help me to strive for frequent awakenings, not mastery. I am enough. Amen.